ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2011, Liz Cameron was an 18-year-old browsing in a bookshop in Canberra when a stranger approached her. This was the beginning of Liz's induction into a cult known as JMS or Providence. And it was an experience that Liz barely survived. But it's not like you make one big decision to join these things. Most cults operate on the same playbook. They spread out this induction process across a series of small but consequential decisions that carry you along into its undertow. There's the love bombing, the constant encouragement to talk about your sorrows, the introduction to the beautiful cult leader, followed by isolation, sleep deprivation, overwork, and sexual manipulation. Liz Cameron was one of many women chosen to become a kind of bride for the cult leader, and she even visited him in prison. Liz has written a memoir, and it's called Cult Bride, How I Was Brainwashed and How I Broke Free. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Richard.
You grew up in Canberra, and you write that you were brought up in the Pentecostalist church that your family belonged to. How involved were you in the life of the church as a kid?
Very involved. It's essentially all I knew, so it was the only belief system I had at the time. It was the kind of Pentecostal church where there was casting out of spirits and shaking and falling and rowdy praise services and lots of prayer vigils. And I really deeply identified with it because, again, it's all I knew.
Was there a belief in the rapture and the coming sort of crisis that might happen in your lifetime?
Oh, yeah, there sure was. Yeah. There was a book series called The Left Behind series. And yes, you look like you're familiar with
it.
And it was all about, you know, it was written for young people to sort of clue them into the idea that the rapture is happening imminently.
Does that make you sort of feel, I don't want to draw this story out too long, but does that make you feel you're like a part of an elect group then if you're sort of within the church that is going to be raised up by the rapture?
I think a sense of elitism is a really key aspect of any kind of high control religion. You know, you sort of believe you're a foot soldier for God and that makes you work harder. There's more of a sense of urgency. So yes, I agree with you.
But even so, even within a church like that, there's often a lot of enormous amount of kindness though too, isn't there?
Yeah. I think those communities, they're full of kind people, they're full of smart people, they're full of absolutely lovely people, and ultimately humans crave community, and that was mine, and I loved it.
You write that you developed an eating disorder in your teens. Did that begin while you were still at school?
That began in 2010, which was my last year of school, year 12, towards the beginning of the year. And it was quite acute, but it was a relatively short episode. Mum got me onto a dietitian very quickly, and I began to refeed and gain my strength back. So I was very much in recovery by the time year 12 finished.
Do you have any ideas or thoughts on what might have triggered that eating disorder, apart from the usual onslaught of teenage anxiety?
Oh, I mean, the teenage anxiety was a huge part of it. I think part of it was a sense of, I mean, I hear a lot of people saying eating disorders are almost like a, well, it's a bit trite to say, but a cry for help, but it's a way to express something that you don't know how to express any other way. It's kind of a self-destructive illness, but it's obviously not intentional. And I think I was a very sheltered child. I was quite a naive child. When I came into year 11 from my tiny little Christian bubble, because I went to a Christian school for a long time, and I was plunged into this public high school, years 11 and 12, I think I found it very overwhelming. I think I felt very isolated. I think because of my Christian upbringing, I didn't quite know how to relate to the other teenagers around me.
Right, this is Canberra's college system, isn't it?
Yes,
which is great, actually.
Yes.
But it's a bit like uni in some ways. And so suddenly you were probably in a lot more cosmopolitan world. Is that what it
Absolutely.
Was?
Absolutely. Yeah. It opened my world up. And I actually loved it because I got to experience things I never did before. I got to make friends with people that were different to what I'd known growing up. But it also made me feel very much like a fish out of water. And I think I felt like I struggled to fit in for a very long time. I felt quite isolated. And I think the eating disorder was a way for me to gain some semblance of control over my life at the time that I didn't feel I had in any other way.
How helpful was your mum in climbing out of this?
Oh, she was wonderful. She was a farm girl, raised in a very post-depression era, utilitarian kind of household. And it was wonderful in many ways, but I don't think eating disorders, mental illness were really much of a thing or weren't acknowledged as much. And so we learned about eating disorders in real time together. So it was a journey for both of us. And she very quickly got me to the doctor and to the dietitian, and she would be there while I was lying on the couch trying to coax me to eat one more cracker. It was, yeah, she was wonderful. Yeah.
So it's 2011 and you were just 18 years old and you're browsing in this Canberra bookshop when a woman approached you. How did she approach you? How did she introduce herself to you?
I was with a friend at this bookstore, and as I was walking out, she kind of popped up behind one of those detectors at the front of the store.
Oh, yeah.
She's a very small lady, East Asian origin, and she spoke in broken English. She was very friendly. She was quite shy. It seemed like shy, but she was assertive. It was a little strange because she turned to me and greeted me, but my friend standing next to me, it was like she wasn't even there. She's basically invisible. I didn't really think much of it at the time. It just struck me as a bit odd. And she introduced herself as a student at a university locally. She didn't specify which one. She said she was studying Australian culture and she had a clipboard and a pen, and she said, I'm doing a survey. Would you mind filling out this survey for me to help me with my assignment? And I was a good Christian girl. I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to oblige. I was also quite impressed by her assertiveness, even with a language barrier. So I agreed and I filled out the survey. There were very general questions. And then the question at the bottom said, are you religious? If so, what religion are you a part of? And I wrote, because I was this very earnest Christian, like it was a job application to heaven, I wrote, I see my faith as more of a relationship with Jesus than a religion.
Right.
And she took the survey back from me. I saw her eyes kind of skim the page until it landed on the last one. And she goes, oh, you're a Christian. And I was like, yeah, I am. And she then followed with, well, I actually am surveying people to find out more about Australian faith. So would you mind giving me your email address? And I can email you the survey questions. And I was that far in, and I just wanted to kind of get away. I was catching a bus. My friend was being completely ignored, so I thought, just give her the email address, we can get rid of her. Sounds horrible, but, you know, you just want to get on with things.
Now, she didn't say she was part of a group. She's just a student, she ostensibly, at this point. She's,
absolutely.
This is her doing something that's notionally part of academic work. That's how she presented herself to you.
Correct. Yes, there was no hint of any religious group, religious affiliation at all. Yeah.
So did you get this second survey?
I did. She followed up a couple of days later with a survey asking questions like, what does your faith mean to you? Do you pray? If so, what do you pray about? How often? Do you read the Bible much? That sort of thing. I was conditioned, I suppose, growing up to really be a representative of my faith. And I also was really genuine. So I answered earnestly, and she responded quite quickly saying, oh, wow, your answers were amazing. You're so pure.
And
I thought, yeah. And I thought, this is a survey for an assignment. I don't know what that means, but I think a little part of me was flattered that she thought these things about me, that she was giving me compliments. And then there was also that voice in my head that was saying, yeah, but she doesn't know you. She's got a tiny piece of context. Why is she praising you so much?
She saw you, but not your friend. So you can see her as someone who sees you as someone with a kind of light pouring out of you.
And I wanted that to be true, in all honesty, you know. I think everyone wants to believe the praise they hear about them. But, of course, there were two conflicting sides of me.
So what was the next approach?
So the next, and this is where it gets to be quite an annoying coincidence, because she kept emailing me. She was kind of going back and forth and saying, she started to introduce herself as a Christian at that point. And she said, we are doing like an art show just to promote like Christian women in the Bible. And would you be willing to be a part of that? And I kind of, at that point, I was like, this is all too much too soon. Like, I've helped her. I just kind of want to, it's a bit awkward.
So bit intimate and tiny bit creepy.
Yeah. A little, yeah. Mm. And but again, because she said she was Christian, and because I'd grown up thinking Christians are the good people, they're safe, they're familiar, I didn't have any reason to believe that there could be something sinister going on.
And so did they send you some of those works of art she was talking about?
Later on they did, but what actually happened was I stopped responding to her emails. And you'd hope that would be the end of it, but I got unlucky. So I was at a different mall on my lunch break. I worked in retail at the time, and I was just browsing a store on my break. And I got another tap on the shoulder, and I turned around to see another East Asian woman. I know.
And she says, do you want to do a survey?
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Exactly, verbatim. I'm a student. I'm doing a survey on Australian culture. Would you mind filling it out? And I had this jolt of recognition and I went, oh, no, I've already done that survey. That's fine. She goes, what's your name? And I said, it's Elizabeth. And she starts getting really excited and she goes, oh, my God, my friend told me about you. I know you. She said your answers on the survey were amazing. And she started praising me all over again. And I'm just a little overwhelmed. And the praise is coming out of I don't know what I did to earn this. And then she says, we're doing the art show. We want to portray women in the Bible. You know, you're really beautiful. Maybe we could paint you as a figure of woman in the Bible, like just use you as a model for that. And I kind of like, I was quite a creative child. So I liked the idea. I thought that's kind of cool. I love that they're promoting the Bible and faith and trying to do it in a contemporary creative way. And she said, I'll email you some follow-ups with some of the images. And again, leaving that interaction, I was in two minds because, oh gosh, that was overwhelming. And why does she know my name? And I didn't realize they were talking about me. And also she heaped all this praise on me and I want to believe it, but it's all too much too soon. And then also the spiritual part of me was going, is this a divinely engineered coincidence? Is this God sort of gently telling me this is a Christian group that you'd benefit from getting to know?
Right, it's a second knock on the door.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And so what did the art look like when she sent it through to you?
It was stunning. Like I expected it to be some crappy middle school art project type thing. And it was incredible. It was, these portraits were just radiant. They captured likeness really well, expressions. Nothing about it was tacky. I was deeply impressed. And so I emailed back and I said, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. And the response was, how about we meet up for coffee first?
Oh, yeah. And what was that meeting like when you met up for coffee?
So that meeting was also interesting. I went to the same spot that I'd first met the first woman in the mall outside the bookstore. And the second woman that I'd met and also an Australian woman who I'd never met showed up. And I thought, oh, that's weird. I thought I was meeting up with the first woman I met, but I'm meeting up with the second and a total stranger. And they were very familiar with me, very warm.
This is also classically from the playbook. You have the first person to bring you in at the lowest level of the organisation. Then when you're ready to be brought in, someone from the next level comes
yes.
in at this point. And this is what was happening to you now?
I think you're right. Yeah, they pull out the big guns when they want to catch a fish. That's a mixed metaphor, but you get what I'm saying.
And what did these bigger guns put to you?
So they brought in an Australian woman who spoke fluent English, I think just to make the communication a little easier. It was really the Australian woman who kind of chatted with me and really wanted to talk about faith. And I had been feeling for a long time, it was my gap year. You know, I was figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. I was trying to find myself. I kind of wanted to lean back into my faith a bit more. I felt like I drifted a little bit. And so I really wanted to talk about faith with people, and she just wanted to talk about that with me. She seemed really wise. She was a lot older than me. I'd say she would have been in her maybe early 30s, and she was so interested in me. She asked me really meaningful questions about myself. She seemed fascinated by what I had to say. She just made me feel really seen, and she suggested, why don't we go back to our apartment, which I know sounds like a red flag. I realize that now. But I'm thinking these are Christian women. She goes, let's go back to the apartment and we can read the Bible together. And so I did. We walked, we talked. And when we came back, she pulled out the Bible. She started reading verses with me. She started explaining how she felt God's love through the verses in a way that I'd never really picked up on before. So I found it quite moving. And then at the end of it, she prayed with me. And the way that she prayed for me made me realize she'd really been listening to me. She really kind of intuited how I was feeling, what I was needing in that moment. Like, I just felt, again, so seen. And when I left, they said, let's catch up again soon. And I just felt like, oh, my God, what wonderful people.
What did they tell you at this point about their group, their church that they were part of?
Oh, nothing meaningful. They said that they were part of a very small house church with just a few members, which was not something that was unfamiliar to me. There were a lot of house churches in the brand of Christianity I grew up in.
What is a house church?
It's basically, instead of going to a church, it's a smaller, more intimate gathering where people have a Sunday service, for example, at their house.
So you started going to Bible study, and then they asked you to come to one of these house church services. Is that what you'd call it?
Yeah.
What was this like?
So by that point, I had done quite a few of the Bible studies, and they were really quite different from what I understood in Christianity, but not in a way that made me suspicious, not in a way that seemed to disagree with Scripture. It was just a different angle, and it felt like a really beautiful interpretation. So I think they waited for a while before they invited me to a service. But at this point, I was very much in the love bombing phase of being indoctrinated. You know, it was like the sun shone out of my ass. They adored me, or so I thought. They felt like mentors. They felt safe. And then, yeah, eventually I was volunteering at my old church at the time. So I took a church service off there to go and visit this house church. And again, I was used to their warmth and their love. And I was not running late. I was just kind of cutting it fine. I turned up, knocked on the door, and I got the coldest reception. And it really just threw me for six, because they opened the door. Normally it was smiles, hellos, hugs. And in this instance, I got stony silence. And they kind of pointed me towards a chair. I had to go sit down, and everyone had their heads bowed in prayer. And so I just kind of followed suit, but I was really stinging from that.
What had you done wrong?
I didn't know at that time. It really put me off balance, because I thought, I know I've done something. What do I do to fix this? But I found at the end of the service, they told me, you need to turn up 10 minutes early out of respect for God. Like, it's disrespectful to turn up on time. You need to pray and prepare your heart for the service. In the same way that they would say things like, you need to dress in beautiful clothes for the service, because it's like you are presenting yourself to God. You wouldn't go in daggy jeans.
Okay, this is the next phase of the playbook. After the love bombing, the sudden and dramatic withdrawal of that love.
Correct.
And then you have to earn it back, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And exactly the same kind of dynamic that you find in narcissistic intimate partner relationships. The love bombing at the beginning, and then all of a sudden something throws you off balance and you're scrambling, and you direct that to yourself and go, I must have done something wrong. How do I fix it?
When I lived in Canberra way back in the day, I was constantly being approached by all kinds of groups to do a free personality test. Canberra seems to be a real focus. I think there's a lot of people who come to Canberra from somewhere else, and they have to come there for work or for study, but they don't know anyone when they arrive. So it seems to be like ground zero for a lot of these groups.
I think so. I think, honestly, any university campus is ground zero for these groups, because they know that many students will be far from their families, potentially even from another country. They will be at a pivotal phase in their life. They're relatively young, idealistic, naive, even if they are smart.
Curious,
yes, open-minded. You know, they're learning new things. They're just in this very transitional phase. So it's the ideal time to intercept that. Cults are very good at sniffing out what the most vulnerable points in someone's life will be and targeting that. For example, I know there's one cult that I won't mention that trolls the death notices in the paper, because they know that the members of that family who've recently lost someone are much more likely to be open to the idea of God at that point in time.
When they handed you their written material that introduced you to their beautiful leader, the gorgeous-souled founder of this church, what did it say?
So they didn't really hand me anything. They would have a sheet that they kind of referred to. They tailored their communication to whoever they were interacting with. With the Bible studies, and now these Bible studies are adapted from the Moonies, 30 Lessons, the Divine Principle, but now they're adapted to point to JMS as the Messiah of the Second Coming. They started planting little stories about this man called Pastor Joshua. And at first they framed it as this is a story about this wonderful pastor in South Korea who really loves God. And that's all it was. He wasn't anyone special. He was just someone who was doing his best to serve God. So that's how I understood it. But it became this sort of thing where every time I would have a Bible study, they would tell me another story about Pastor Joshua and how wonderful he was. And I started to sort of think, like, why? How is he doing all these things? They said he read the Bible 1,000 times, which I really should have punched the maths on, because that's years of your life without stopping, without sleeping, without eating, even for the fastest reader. And fasted and prayed for 40 days in a cave. Extreme stuff like that, but also some nice stuff like feeding a beggar on the street. So
fasted for 40 days?
Yes.
Okay. Did anything in your mind at that point go, that's not possible and he'd be dead if he tried to do that?
Yeah, I did. And I certainly had a lot of little moments where I was like, this is all quite extreme. I can't quite get my head around this. But there was this aspect of spiritualism that they would apply to it. You know, the sense that if you are following God and God's anointed you to do something, anything's possible. And with faith, anything's possible.
Meanwhile, what about your family and your old friends at the old church you'd belong to? Were you telling them about these new funky people you were encountering and hanging out with?
Yeah, very excitedly. I was like, I've met these amazing Christians. They're teaching me these wonderful Bible studies. You know, I think they're incredible. I think you should do them too. Like, they're lovely. You should meet them. And I was really confused when I was kind of met with suspicion, because I thought, what, like, they're Christians. What could you possibly be concerned about? Now, with my old church, I know that there was this sense of, well, why don't you think our church is good enough for you? Why are you wanting to go somewhere else?
Did you search online for more information about this new church? What was it calling itself at this point?
So I tried to. They call themselves Sarang Church, which is Korean for love, Canberra Love Church. And because I understood it to be a small house church, I mean, house churches don't really have a website. They're just an informal or semi-formal gathering of people. So I did look them up, but of course there was nothing, and Pastor Joshua would give you a million results. And that's all I knew, and I didn't realise that there was more to this church than just Canberra. It wasn't until I was pretty much fully indoctrinated that they actually told me, oh, this is who we are, this is what we represent, and this is who Pastor Joshua is.
They introduced you to a concept called setting a condition. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Setting a condition is a concept where you try and prove to God or show God that you are dedicated to him and you want to hear from him. And it's not unique to JMS. It's certainly something that happens in pretty much any religion. It's setting a prayer condition, which would be saying, I'm going to pray for this long, for this many days.
All right. Well, so yep. This seemed pretty innocuous to you at the time then?
Yeah, I thought it made sense. And it wasn't something I was unfamiliar with growing up.
But what were these conditions though?
So a large one was the sleep deprivation. Back then it was introduced to me as you should give God the best part of your day. So wake up early, pray first, and then get on with your day.
Like how early?
So they started out by saying 5 because they didn't want to scare me. Later down the track, it became 2, 3 a.m. And you were only supposed to sleep 4 hours max.
What were you supposed to do at 2 a.m.?
Pray.
How long for?
Hours.
Is that possible without letting your mind wander? Can you stay that focused on prayer for that long?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I might not be the best example. I certainly didn't. I did my best.
And then as you drift away, as the mind wanders off, do you feel ashamed then and like you failed and you're not good enough and all of that?
I think a huge part of cults is taking meticulous inventory of your inner thoughts and feelings and rebuking yourself if you do something wrong.
So then you were told, we're all going to Melbourne. Mm-hmm. We're all going from Canberra to Melbourne. What was on in Melbourne and what was going to be your role in this big trip?
So I was introduced to the fact that they do modelling classes.
Modelling classes?
Yes, which is something that you'd sort of think, well, what's that got to do with religion? That seems completely divorced from that world. Their way of interpreting it was modelling is a way that we give glory to God by presenting ourselves beautifully. And, you know, it sounds, you know, when I hear myself talking about this, A, I think it feels like I'm talking about someone else. B, it's so outlandish and I completely recognise that. So I do want to acknowledge that. It's bizarre.
Well, Liz, you were 19.
I was.
You're 19 and yep. Someone says, I want you to look beautiful for Jesus. Well, you said yes to that.
I did. And I honestly thought the way they presented it to me, I thought it was a great idea because it was different from what I'd grown up with, which is it doesn't matter how you present your body because the spirit's the only thing that matters. But to me, JMS were presenting this more holistic way of living for God. So they said, we do modelling classes. It's giving glory to God. We have a church that we're friends with in Melbourne. They're running like a modelling show, a catwalk. Will you come up and help us? Now, I was far in enough that they were framing it as you could assist us with this show. And I thought, great, like I can help. I can do something, get involved. Because they'd been giving to me this whole time. I felt like I was just turning up. They were feeding me, giving me a Bible study, and I can give back. So I went to Melbourne and we had a lot of young women similar to me, very tall, very slim women. And one of the members from the church that I was at whispered to me, oh, so some of them are at different points in the Bible study, so maybe just don't mention the Bible studies. Some of them haven't even started the Bible studies, so don't, you know, say anything about that. We just want to encourage them to have a good show.
Oh, my. So like there were these other tall, beautiful women there, mm-hmm. and they'd been invited to be part of this quote-unquote fashion show. Mm-hmm. So they were potential new inductees. So,
correct.
So you back off. Don't give them the hard word about the new thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the front group thing comes in here. Whatever group it might be, it could be soccer, could be art, could be modelling as it was with us. And you will attract people to that to do the thing that you're advertising, but it's a way for them to suss out who might be open to hearing their message and pick people off the fringes. That's what a front group is for.
This is a new one for me, I have to say. The inductee being chosen like you've been cast by a modelling agent, that's a new one. That's a new one for me.
It's a great in because if you approach someone and say, you're really beautiful, do you do modelling? You've immediately ingratiated yourself to them. It's a compliment. They're caught off guard. They go, oh, thank you so much. No, I don't do modelling. Oh, well, we run a modelling group. So it's a great way to get people in who aren't Christian. You don't have to use the Bible study angle. And the way that the doctrine worked, as I would find out later, was that, you know how in the Old Testament, people are in the position of servants to God. In the New Testament, because of Jesus, people are in position of children to God. In the complete Testament, they're brides to God.
What happened down in Melbourne during this show?
So the show happened. Funnily enough, the theme was heavenly brides. So we were all given these extravagant wedding dresses to wear.
Were they conservative wedding dresses or sexy wedding dresses? What were they like?
They were mostly conservative.
Yeah.
They were beautiful in their own way, but yeah, quite conservative. We'd walk the red carpet. They'd hired a big building. They had a lot of what I realised looking back were members of the church as the audience. And it was a good show. I mean, there was nothing really notable that happened. A lot of the women in that show, I don't think were doing Bible studies. I think they were just part of what they thought was a legitimate modelling group.
And then the church service you went to in Melbourne after that. What happened there?
At the time, I hadn't been fully inducted. I didn't know who JMS was. I didn't know Providence, any of that. So we had a Sunday service with the Melbourne church. We thought, let's combine churches and we'll do a Sunday service. And to me, I thought, it's a normal, nice service. There were probably about 40 people in attendance and we had a normal sermon. I remember thinking, oh, it seems a bit bland, but okay. But everyone else was kind of reacting like, oh, it's the most meaningful thing they've ever heard. And that's a very cult-like thing, you know, something. The more simple it is, the more profound. And if you don't get it, then you're just not spiritual enough. Huh. So I just sort of remember this sense of guilt. But it wasn't until much later when I was fully inducted that I remember one of the girls from the Canberra church who had been teaching me the Bible studies. She breathed this sigh of relief and she goes, oh my God, Melbourne was so stressful, Liz. And I was like, oh, why is that? And she goes, because we had to change the entire church service for you. We had to take down all the pictures of JMS. We had to completely change the sermon. We had to change all the songs.
Wow.
Yes.
Right.
She'd been stuck to me that whole time.
So you're in I'm going to use a very strange phrase here, some kind of Potemkin village of normality all of a sudden. And this is
yes.
Getting weird now.
It's, yes.
So it's like, hide the weirdness, Liz is coming.
Yes.
It was all about you.
That's right. Everyone. And I remember thinking, I was a little hurt because she goes, I couldn't leave your side that whole trip just in case someone said something wrong. And she said, I had to look at some of the members if they started to say something I thought was going to be risky. I had to, you know, bore my eyes into their skull or steer you away so you didn't hear the wrong thing. And, of course, I was brainwashed at the time when I heard this, so, yes, it was weird, but I also understood at that point that that's what we did for all new members. That's what they'd been doing for me in the Canberra church, and that's what they did for the parents as well. If your parents want to visit the church, they'll make sure it's a Christian
right,
service.
I'll normal it down a bit, right, or normal it up or down. I'm not sure how that ratchet works.
Yeah.
So when you got back to Canberra after this experience in Melbourne, you get in touch with your family again. Were they starting to get worried about you at this point?
Yeah. So my mum in particular was. I think my dad wasn't so clued into what was happening, but I was spending more and more time with them, as you do when you start to get inducted into a cult. I was loving it. I was on this, you know, euphoric spiritual high in so many ways. But mum, every time I would leave, she started to say things like, oh, why are you spending so much time with them? And I was really, at the time, quite frustrated because I was thinking, you know, I could be doing so much worse. I could be going out and doing drugs. You know, I could be doing anything. I'm going to a Bible study. Why are you worried?
Yeah, but your mum had nursed you through an eating disorder.
Yes.
And I think any parent who's done that and then sees her daughter suddenly,
yeah,
who's joined this fabulous, new, interesting, strange group of people, she was worried.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I certainly didn't see that at the time. I just wanted my independence. And I also wanted her to be excited for me because I was so excited about this.
And when you told your new friends in the new church about your mum's concerns for you, what did they say about that?
So that is a major red flag for people in cults, leaders in cults, because they use legitimate verses in the Bible, you know, to say that Jesus didn't come to bring truth but a sword. You know, he came to separate father from son, mother from daughter, to say, if you're really following the truth, you have to leave everything behind and follow me.
I don't remember hearing that in the Sermon on the Mount, but anyway, that's kind of fascinating. So this is the next part of the cult playbook, which mm-hmm. is to cut you off from your family.
Correct. So I'd like to mention that Stephen Hassan's bite model here, because I think it adds a lot to the conversation, which is they will start to try and draw in control in four elements, which is behaviour, information, thought and emotions. So when it comes to cutting you off from friends and family, they're trying to restrict the influence that you have in your life. They try to make you suspicious of the people closest to you outside of the group because they know they're going to be the people who notice a difference in you. They notice your personality change. And so they'll make them the enemy. So they started saying things like, the Christians out in the world, they don't really understand how close the rapture is and how we should be giving everything to God. They're kind of just like rainy day Christians.
Yeah, this is the consistent message that that church your parents asked to, that's not a real church.
Yes.
This is a real church.
Exactly.
This is the same message that was used to radicalise young Muslim guys. That mosque your dad goes to, that nice mosque with all those nice people, that's not a real mosque.
Yes.
This is the real mosque.
It's that sense of elitism. It's that sense of we're the real ones.
We're the elect.
And so they did say Satan is going to use those closest to you to try to get you to stop following what God really wants for your life.
And so Satan is here now, is he? Satan's,
correct.
Satan's in the room now messing about with your life.
Correct. And that's how it's all framed. It's framed that way in many Christian churches as well, is that everything is a spiritual battle. It's not as it seems on the surface. Everything is a spiritual battle.
Pastor Joshua, the leader of this organisation, how did you start to learn more about this man, Pastor Joshua, and his living circumstances?
I was far enough along in the Bible studies that I think they felt, okay, it's probably time to tell her a bit more about Pastor Joshua. Now, they still didn't tell me his real name, but they said, we want to tell you about something about Pastor Joshua. It might be alarming, but he is currently in prison now because of persecution of Christians happening in South Korea. And I knew that there were many countries where apparently Christians were being put into prison because they were Christians rather than another faith.
Just like the Romans did way back in the day.
Yes, exactly like that. And they said he's had these horrible allegations levelled at him that were proven completely false, but they put him away anyway. And I said, what are the allegations? And they said there were these women who falsely claimed that he had sexually assaulted them, but they weren't even willing to show their face. And later they admitted that they were lying. It's just Satan trying to stop God's will from happening in South Korea. So I kind of took a bit to digest that, and I'd built up enough of a trust and friendship with these women that I wanted to believe them. I didn't really have any reason not to at that stage. So I said, well, that's horrible and I'm so sorry. And they said, don't look him up. Like, don't, if you look anything up, at this point I still didn't know his name, so I really couldn't. They were being very careful. But if you look anything up, if you see any slander, that's the same as shooting yourself in the spirit or poisoning yourself in the spirit, because it's going to poison you.
What do you now know about this Pastor Joshua? Who is this man?
So this man, he originally, as I understand it, came from the Unification Church, the Moonies. He broke out of that in the late 70s, formed his own sect called Jesus Morning Star or Providence. And it's another kind of Christian Bible-based cult that essentially preys on people, of course, as any cult does, but he happens to be a rapist. The cult specifically grooms young, good-looking women to be his quote-unquote brides, and it's run on that basis.
How did they put it to you that they wanted you to become his bride?
So they told me about this concept called a faith star or an evergreen. They introduced the concept to me as a way of saying this is almost like a nun. It was how I understood it at the time. I thought that it's you dedicating your whole life to the church and to him, and just happened to be conceptually called a bride because of what I explained about the theology that they had.
Any Christian church would have a view on this. This sounds like pure idolatry to me.
It sure does.
I mean, this is idolatry, surely. Did that ring an alarm bell in your head, Liz?
Yes, absolutely. There were moments when I did do that, and their response was always go and pray about it, because I didn't feel safe at that point talking to anyone outside my circle because I knew they'd find it crazy. But again, what I didn't realise was that they'd given me this, the lens by which I viewed the world, like the conditioning over time was having an effect on me. And so I was interpreting things through their lens without even knowing it. I could look at a puddle, for goodness sakes, and think that God was trying to tell me something. They disorient you and then they kind of reprogram you with their ideas.
Given you think that God and Pastor Joshua and Jesus on one side and Satan on the other side are at war for your soul, were you very, very frightened at times for this?
Absolutely, yeah. Especially when they brought in the concept of the rapture happening imminently, because it was, yeah, this sense of urgency that cults often use, which is, it's happening, it's about to happen, you need to prepare yourselves. And that gets people to work harder, longer. They get more committed to the cause. But with that comes this intense psychological pressure, because I constantly was thinking, I'm not doing the right thing, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough. And there was a lot of fear there around reading the wrong things, seeing the wrong things, saying the wrong things. Yeah, it was terrifying.
So given that you were selected to become a bride, because there were many brides for Pastor Joshua, you started writing to him. What did you write to him?
So we were encouraged to write whatever was in our hearts to him. Looking back, obviously that was a way to surveil members, but I thought it was just this innocent, like, he cares about me, he loves me. So I was encouraged to write to him, especially as a faith star, by saying, I love you, I pray for you, I'm so sorry you're in prison, I feel your pain.
Did he ever write back?
Yeah, he did. Now, I would probably say there were some letters that were written by the headquarters, as if they were from him, but some of the letters were far too sexually explicit to be from someone else. And when I visited him, I know he recognised me.
Your parents were getting increasingly worried about you. Your dad tried to come around and see you. What happened when he came around to the place you were staying in to come and see you?
Oh, yeah. So that was actually just before we went to Korea. I was told to tell my parents that we were going to like a Bible camp in Perth because they thought she was a bit dangerous, was a risk to my faith. She drove me home back to where I was living with them because I'd moved in with them by this point. And she pulled out this whole stack of papers and she said, Liz, I found some sermons under your bed. And I looked up the name of the group and I just wanted to talk to you about some stuff. And that basically just triggered the tripwire response of this is dangerous and I need to leave, because we've been programmed that, again, if you hear any slander or anything opposing the views of the cult, that it's deeply dangerous.
This is Satan working through your mother.
Yes.
Was it? Right.
And basically her waving those papers in my face, I was at risk of my eternal life, as dramatic as it sounds. That's how I perceived it. That's how I was conditioned. So I ran inside and immediately told my head leader, and she said, don't worry, it'll be fine. We just need you to stay away from your mum for a while. But then she quickly came back and said, your mum's gone home and come back and your dad's here. And so she made me hide in the closet. My dad approached the house and I heard him just yelling my name and he sounded terrified. And I just remember feeling so conflicted because I was scared of them at that point, scared of Satan working through them, you know. And I was also, it was horrible to hear my dad so scared. Anyway, eventually I was able to come out of the closet, literally, not figuratively. And then my head leader said, you need to pack your stuff. We're going to go to Korea now. We were due to go the next day, but we went a day early. We had a big van. They popped me in the back of the van. They threw a blanket over me just in case my parents were still kind of driving around looking for me, basically just smuggled me out of Canberra. And then, yeah, I was on the next plane to South Korea.
Tell me about that visit to Korea when you met Pastor Joshua in prison.
Yeah, so we went to South Korea. I had to get all dressed up, you know, and visit him in this prison. His second in command kind of let us in, and we saw him get taken in by a guard behind a plexiglass screen, sat opposite him. And
what did his appearance do to you? Because this is the first time you've seen the beautiful soul.
Yeah.
The Messiah. How did you feel seeing him in person for the first time?
I felt like I should be feeling more. I felt like I should be having this amazing spiritual experience.
Oh, really? And you weren't getting that?
And I wasn't.
Because it's really common to get that very often with the great guru. Yeah. They'll see Rajneesh in person and they'll go, oh, my God.
Yes,
oh, my God. I love him. But you didn't get that from this guy.
No. And
what did you see when you looked at him? What did he look like?
He was this little old man in a prison jumpsuit. He looked a lot more tired than he was in the pictures they would show us of him, because he just looks like this amazing, tall, handsome man, and he's actually not any of those things at all. But he kind of croaked out my name and I just had this moment of, oh, my God, he really does. He knows my name. And then he kind of translated a few things to us through our head leader who was in the room. And I just felt guilt when I left, because I was like, shouldn't I have felt more? And that made me want to pray and repent that I didn't realize enough what I was supposed to realize. I wasn't spiritual enough to have that experience.
When you got back to Australia, you write that your health started to deteriorate. Mm. What was happening to you at the time, Liz?
So for one thing, obviously, there was the level of stress that we were all dealing with. You know, we were working around 20 hours a day, doing many menial tasks. Repetition is a huge part of keeping people indoctrinated. Also running front groups, like I was running the modelling groups. We had to do so many things. And on top of that, I was studying. And on top of that, we were all trying to make ourselves perfect for the rapture that was happening at the end of the year. And this was 2012. It was based on a Nostradamus prophecy, apparently. So incredible amounts of stress that I think kind of triggered the eating disorder again. But at the same time, the leader was obsessing about all of our weights. She would weigh us, you know, she would tell us to lose or gain weight. A lot of people were fasting for days on end. I started losing weight and then getting a bit sick, and she would tell me that that was my sin. That was Satan getting into my mind. So then she put me on a really strict diet. Wasn't allowed to eat breakfast, even though you're getting up at 2. Like, I was really only allowed to eat a very small amount of foods and not very calorie dense. So my weight nosedived, and with my weight nosediving, I got further punished for getting sick. There was no understanding of, oh, this is actually a really genuine illness. You're willfully doing this.
How did you start to get some medical help and get out of this spiral that you were in, Liz?
So it took a while. I ended up being hospitalised at one point because when you lose enough weight, your internal organs start to atrophy, and so my bowel was too weak to work, and I was just incredibly constipated and taken to the hospital. And that kind of triggered the need for a colonoscopy. And the cult didn't want to deal with that, but they said, look, your mum's permitted to take you to a specialist. And got the colonoscopy, was losing more weight all the time, but they were also working me harder. It felt like a bit of a punishment. I remember them criticising me for how bony I was, and I'd be made to repent for and fast for it and things like that.
Is this all about we need you to be a hot chick for Pastor Joshua?
Yes. One of the things they specifically said to me, my head leader said, he won't find you pretty looking like that. Yeah.
How did you finally get some help, some proper help to get you out of this awful spiral, Liz?
So I wasn't much use to them while I was that sick. And at this point, I was having panic attacks regularly, all those sorts of things. So they finally said, okay, your mum can take you to the doctor. And I remember the doctor telling me, if you don't get help, if you don't put on weight, your heart's going to stop. You're going to shut down. You're going to die. Because she was asking questions like, you know, are you happy where you're living? You know, your mum says there might be some issues with your housemates. And I was like, no, they're wonderful. They're great. They're absolutely amazing. It's just me. But I think she knew was more than that, because she was saying, well, you really need to move back home to get well again. In my head, I was like, that's the worst thing I could possibly do. I'll go to hell. It's much better to die in the group than to go to hell and leave. So I was genuinely prepared to die. But eventually they gave mum permission to admit me to hospital, to an eating disorders unit. And this was a bit further down the track. And the relief I felt that I would get some reprieve was immense, even though I felt a huge amount of guilt for getting myself into that position as they framed it.
And then the cult cut you loose.
Yeah, quite dramatically.
How did they do that?
I was so fortunate that my mum managed to convince the psychiatrist to discharge me home to her in the first instance rather than back to the group house. By that point, I was thinking, I'll probably go back. I need to go back. But then, again, a bit of relief when I found out that actually I might get to go home for a couple of weeks, and I thought I'll just get my strength up a little bit, hopefully. But mum had staged an intervention. I was just eating my breakfast, and mum goes, darling, why don't you put your regular clothes on? You're in jammies. And I was like, why? She's like, oh, your uncle's coming over. And I heard footsteps at the front, and I heard two sets of footsteps, and I was like, what's going on? I come out, my uncle's there, who's wonderful, by the way, and this little man with a polo shirt tucked into cargo pants, and I've never seen him before in my life, and obviously I get this sinking feeling that I'm going to need to run away. And he goes, hi, my name's Rick. I'm just here to talk to you. Your mum asked me to come and have a chat to you about the group that you're in. Immediately, I've got to get out of here. So I was like, I'm going to go for a walk. I went into my room, and I was getting changed into my runners, and Mum came in and I could see her like shaking, and she pulled me into this really tight hug and she just whispered to me, "Lizzie, please don't run away." And I could feel her shaking. She was holding me, and I guess at that moment I was like, yeah, I feel like I should, but I can't do that to her. It really got through to me because I could feel how scared she was for me. And so I went on a walk and I did think about running away still, but I came back and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to get through this. I'll block out everything he's saying to me. I know this is an attack from Satan, but I'll just sit through it just to keep Mum happy, and then I can go back to the house because obviously I need to get out of here. So the first day happened, and man, this man does not take breaks from talking. He talked the entire day. It was probably 9 till 5 or 6 for that first day. And I was trying to chant things in my head and kind of block out what he was saying the whole time. But he wasn't actually directly attacking Providence. I thought he would just go, you know, guns blazing, kind of be like, "Do you know who this man is and do you know what they've done?" And I'd have all the program dancers for it, being like, "That's all a lie and it's slander and everything."
What tack did he take then?
So what he did was he started talking about, in general terms, about other cults, the Moonies, Scientology, like all the different cults out there. He would just bring in little tidbits here and there. And it's kind of like, well, he's not attacking me, so I was happy to listen. But there's only so long you can hear example after example after example of what sounds like exactly what you've gone through. Yeah, without being like, yeah, but my group is different. But it still took 2 full days before I fully broke.
How did you break?
I remember getting in my mum's car, driving across to the parking lot and just screaming. I was just so confused and so traumatized. And I remember praying and saying, like, "God, this is the time that I need you. I need you to help me. You know, I'm in so much danger. Where are you?" And I was trying to contact members of the group and they weren't really picking up. Later in the night, they were calling me all through the night, trying to get me to fly to Melbourne with them, just get out of there. And at that point, I was too scared to go with them as well. So I felt really caught in the middle of two potentially dangerous entities and not knowing what's going on.
But your mum was there.
She was there, but I did not want to bar of her. I was so angry with her. I really took it out on her and have felt terrible about doing that. But at the time, I'd been conditioned to see her as the enemy.
When did the little tower of crappy bricks in your head finally crumble?
Yes. Liz? So that would have been in the afternoon of the second day. It was almost like shrugging off a coat. I guess I came around to what the truth was.
Was there a surrender?
Yeah, that's the word. Yeah, it was a surrender.
How did you surrender?
I interrupted him and I said, "Okay, I understand. Like, I understand Providence is a cult. I get it now. Just tell me everything you know about him." And so he goes, "Great." Opens his briefcase, pulls out a stack of papers, puts them down, and then starts telling me the history of the group. And then we spent the whole next day talking about it. And he guided me through that.
Was it traumatic?
Deeply, yeah. You know, you build up this whole idea of, you know, who you are, and I'd given my life to this, essentially, and to have found out that actually I was just being abused and lied to and brainwashed was just, it was really overwhelming for me to come to terms with.
Your soul wasn't the battlefield for the end of the world?
No.
You weren't that important, actually.
That's right. Yes, I know, very sad. But no, it was very disorienting. And now I had to come to terms with what was left, which was I was very sick. I didn't have any money. I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything.
Were you sleeping again?
Oh, so much. Yeah. When I came out, I was sleeping about 12 hours a night. I spent a lot of the time just zoned out if I wasn't crying or having a panic attack. It was really, really the most difficult year of my life. You know, you'd think that things would feel better when you come out of a cult, but actually, the hardest part for me was getting my life back.
Did you try and make contact with these people afterwards, after you'd been deprogrammed?
Yes, I did. I sent an email to one of the members there at the time saying, "I don't want to be in this group anymore. This doesn't align with who I am." That wasn't passed on. I think they painted whatever story they wanted to paint about me leaving, but I wanted my bond back because I had no money. It was about $400, but it was a lot to me at the time. So I had to go to one of their houses to sign the release papers for the bond. And my mum came with me and they basically ambushed us. They had leaders from the group in Korea, you know, some of the head leaders there, and they pulled out all these papers and said, these are the people we've sued in the past. If you keep spreading lies, we'll sue you for defamation. We'll ruin your life. Because at this point, I had spoken to the media a little bit. Mum and I felt like we had a responsibility to warn people that this group was active.
And when they issued threats like that, how did you feel about that? What kind of emotional response did that do? Fear or rage?
Rage. I fear underneath the rage, but rage was my first. I laughed at that. It was a stupid response, but that it just made me crack up. And then I said, I'm not going to lie about the group, but I will continue to tell the truth. And then I left and Mum and I are sitting in the car and we're both just shaking. It was scary.
You sound like you're doing really well. I mean, been some years since you've been out of this damn thing. But how are you doing? Are you doing that as well as I say you are?
Thanks, Richard. I'm glad it comes across that way. I am more me than I ever have been. You know, I must say I'm not religious anymore, but, you know, I respect religion. Not all cults are religious and not all religions are cults, but I'm doing quite well. I'm very happy in my life. Obviously, I still feel like I'm rebuilding in some ways, but for the most part, I'm good. It's scary to talk about them sometimes, but I think the more we do speak out about it, the safer we all are.
And where is this Pastor Joshua now?
He's back in prison. So he was reconvicted in December of 2023, 17-year sentence for numerous counts of molestation, rape and quasi-rape, which is rape when someone is asleep. That's because of the efforts of this amazing man in Korea called Kim Do-hyung. He's a professor of mathematics in Korea, and he helped two survivors from the group speak out about him.
It's an amazing story, Liz, and it's really great you've come forward to expose all this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liz Cameron's memoir is called Cult Bride, How I Was Brainwashed and How I Broke Free. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. The producer was Jennifer Leake, and executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.